Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. The war, of course, takes many forms at the moment. One of the most insidious and difficult to understand for many is the sort of stealthy assault on Western civilization that is being undertaken by, generally speaking, several allied entities or factions or groups. The left, with its agenda of displacing, replacing sovereign nations with some sort of regional or global order, usually at the expense of freedom and certainly individual rights, and their unlikely allies among the Sharia supremacists. I say unlikely allies because, after all, the Sharia supremacists are very hostile to many of the pillars of the left, feminists, Jews, homosexuals, apostates, and the like. A woman who understands all of this extraordinarily well and is doing incredibly important work in her native Austria in raising the alarm about what this so-called red-green axis is up to and in challenging it in the most extraordinary way in the face of considerable opposition, indeed even persecution and prosecution by her government, is, I'm thrilled to say, our guest for a full hour of conversation. Her name is Elizabeth Sabadich-Wolf. She has been with us in the past. We've collaborated for many years with the work that we do at the Center for Security Policy, but it's always a very educational moment when we're able to catch up with her and take stock of what is going on both in her native land, Austria, and in the region, and most especially to help us think through what all of this means for us here at home. Elizabeth Sabadich-Wolf, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. It's so good to have you, and thank you for giving so generously of your time today.
Thank you, Frank, for having me on your show. It's always an honor and even more so a pleasure to speak with you.
Well, the pleasure is mutual. Elizabeth, you have a very interesting background that has made you into, I think, the authority on some of these matters that you are and has, well, certainly informed the work that you do to raise alarms about what's happening to Western civilization and our freedoms. Give us a little bit of your personal biography, if you would.
I'm a diplomat's daughter. Some would call me a diplomat's brat. Part of my childhood was spent not only in New York City, where I attended kindergarten and learned English for the first time, but also, and I think that's even more important, experiencing the transition from a fairly Western-oriented, fairly free Iran to a Ayatollah Khomeini disaster in terms of personal freedoms and especially women's rights in Iran. So I experienced both sides of one coin, if you will. You know, you have on the one hand, you have freedom. On the other hand, you have disaster, catastrophe, dark ages, return to unfreedom in the truest sense. And this is what I experienced as a six-year-old, seven-year-old. And, you know, one would think that has no repercussions on you if you experience something at the age of six. But I can tell you, the transition from the Shah Iran to the Khomeini Iran is what brought me to who I am, what I stand for. The second most important impact is probably the time that I spent in Chicago in the 1980s when I attended school as a teenager, as a young teenager, when I was compelled to study the U.S. Constitution in order to graduate from eighth grade.
Isn't that charming? Back in the day when we used to do that sort of thing in this country.
Exactly. And I'm shocked to hear that this is no longer done. But, you know, this is what has shaped me because, as you probably know, because I mention it all the time, I'm probably unique in the sense that I'm an Austrian who loves and appreciates and respects and knows the United States Constitution, what it stands for. I believe it's the greatest document ever written. I think it's the simplest that even an eighth grader can understand. And it contains the Bill of Rights, and most notably what I fight for. And the, what is so personally important to me, it is the First Amendment. And I call...
Specifically freedom of speech?
Europe. Freedom of speech. This is the most important freedom that we need to fight for because without freedom of speech, all other freedoms are gone. I mean, there's a reason why it's called the First Amendment and not the Tenth Amendment.
Well, we certainly are watching it under assault in our own country. But as you say, you don't have it at all in your own, nor do most nations, even in what we think of as the free world, at least in a formal, you know, mandated, enshrined way. It's maybe a tradition. It may be even something that is regarded as an important value of societies. But it is under assault. And I'd like to ask you a bit about the assault you have been under in Austria, Elizabeth Sabatisch-Wolf, as you have sought to exercise free speech and also to ensure that it was not sacrificed in the name of political correctness or Sharia blasphemy.
Again, because I was raised in an atmosphere and a surrounding of this appreciation for the First Amendment, and having spent some of my formative years in the United States where I exercised this right, I was naively of the opinion that I would also be able to exercise my right to freedom of speech here in Austria. You know, as a matter of fact, we have those so-called fundamental rights that are granted by the European Union, and those rights apparently also include freedom of speech. However, it's a freedom of speech with a but at the end. And as you well know, a freedom of speech with a but is not freedom of speech. It's a semblance of freedom of speech. And this is what I have experienced, what I continue to experience, and what got me in trouble with the law.
And on that, I want to pause for just a second. We have to come back, Elizabeth Sabatisch-Wolf, and we will talk a bit about what you were subjected to by the legal authorities in Austria. We'll be right back with much more with a great freedom fighter from Austria, Elizabeth Sabatisch-Wolf, right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back. We are joined for this full hour by Elizabeth Sabatisch-Wolf, a great patriot of Austria, but really of the free world. She is a mother. She is an English tutor. You can tell by her extraordinary proficiency in English that she is very good at that. But she is also very good at freedom fighting, which she has been doing both in Austria and throughout Europe, and indeed making it clear to the rest of us, including on this side of the pond, that there's a lot on the line if it's lost there. Elizabeth, you were just about to tell us a bit about what has happened to you at the hands of your government, which has decided, having granted you rights, or the European Union having granted you rights, has decided to restrict yours. Tell us about it.
Isn't that marvelous? It was granted to me. Apparently, I was, again, naive to think that I would be able to educate people back in 2009 about what I viewed as a grave danger about Islam. And I presented a fully sourced four-hour PDF presentation to interested people who happened to be from the Freedom Party, which was back then an opposition party, and now is part of the government. And there was a young lady who smuggled herself into my seminars and reported me to the authorities. To make a long story short, the authorities did not find it amusing that I was informing and educating people about Islam, and I was dragged into court at first for hate speech charges. I was acquitted on those, but during the proceedings, the judge at her own discretion added another charge, which was, and it sounds ludicrous to American ears, defamation of religious teachings of a legally recognized religion in Austria. And of course, I was found guilty. I was fined, and I then took it, all the way up to the almost Supreme Court. It was the Supreme Court, was found, guilty all the way to the Supreme Court. And the case is currently still pending. It's now in its seventh year at the European Court of Human Rights, which is a supranational institution. And I'm still waiting for the verdict because it's an important verdict, not for myself, but for Europe, for the future of free speech in Europe, and for my daughter. And that's why I'm fighting. And you know very well, Frank, my daughter is my guiding light.
Indeed. Elizabeth, just help us understand what this idea of defamation of an established religion means. And how does it differ, if at all, from the practice under this totalitarian Islamic code, its adherents call Sharia, from what they would term Sharia blasphemy restrictions?
Well, this is precisely what Sharia blasphemy laws intend to do. They intend to frighten you into silence,
into submission.
Submission, silence. They want to set an example for others. You better shut up, because otherwise the same thing will happen to you. And I lost my job. People didn't look at me very kindly. I was alienated. There's no chance for me to get another "quote unquote decent job." The state wanted to set an example, and they did a marvelous job.
And when you say that you can't get another decent job, that's because this is on your record, that it would make your employers very nervous that you are somebody who is going to be a trouble raiser and perhaps bring down problems with the law on them as well.
I mean, nowadays I wouldn't hire me, definitely not. Because, I'm like you said, I am a troublemaker, and I'm proud of it. If I'm a troublemaker for freedom and freedom of speech, then I'm very glad to be called a troublemaker, because we need an army of troublemakers, and I'm a lone voice. So, we really should be louder.
Elizabeth, I've been talking on this program now for some time about something that is very ominous emerging from totalitarian communist China, namely this idea of a social credit score. And it seems as though you are basically experiencing precisely that kind of phenomenon, whether it's formalized or, in a very structured way. It is unfortunately the case that the bottom line is you are being punished in much the way that the Chinese are now punishing their dissidents, or, if you will, freedom fighters. Is that right?
I totally agree with you. I think this is, we're on a path to the Chinese way of punishing dissidents. However, I don't want to just talk about myself. I think it's also important to keep in mind when we talk about dissidents like I am here in Austria, that we do not forget about people like Tommy Robinson, who are in the crosshairs of an increasingly totalitarian United Kingdom. What I experience in Austria is absolutely nothing compared to what people like Tommy Robinson have to go through.
Including incarceration.
Including incarceration, but keep in mind, he has a wife and children. It's not just Tommy who's being persecuted, it's his wife. And we tend to forget that there's a family behind him. And if his wife didn't support him, Tommy would stand no chance to fight. You always have to have your spouse, your family supporting you. And in this, this will also allow me to salute my husband, who's been behind me all the way. I mean, he could have asked for a different wife who is not as outspoken, who does her ironing every day and cooks a lunch for him and my daughter every day. But instead, she's a different kind of person. And, we really need to salute these families behind the dissidents as well, because otherwise, those dissidents would not be doing what they're doing.
Yeah. This is such an important point because it really personalizes what you're experiencing. And you've shared with me in the past, Elizabeth, that the personal level is very much in play here in the sense that you live in a neighborhood in which there now are increasingly people who you have reason to believe are very hostile to what you have chosen to do to try to defend freedom, including freedom of speech, but the other freedoms too, freedom of religion, freedom of association, we take for granted in this country. Talk a little bit about what's happening and what it's doing to Austria that is further reinforcing this sort of constriction of freedom in your country.
I have to set the scene here. I'm lucky enough to live in an affluent neighborhood of Vienna, or shall I say a formerly affluent neighborhood of Vienna. It's got the real estate is extremely expensive. It's probably the second or third expensive in Vienna. And it's been a very quiet and very almost quaint neighborhood. But this changed in 2015 when the great migration crisis set in, because almost around the corner from where I live, there's a big hospital that was no longer a hospital, but was converted into a refugee center. And it housed about 1,000 young male refugees.
And where did they come from?
What have you? I mean, Afghanistan, Iran, not as much. There are more and more Iranians coming now, but back then it was Afghanistan, Pakistan, probably some Syrians. But I was always wondering why Syrians looked like Afghans and not like Syrians. But then again, it just might have been me. And then you'd start seeing the differences. More and more people who leave these refugee centers are starting to be housed in normal apartment buildings. And I can give you a concrete example. My neighbors are now Iraqi refugees. It's a family with four daughters from northern Iraq. From what I've gleaned, having lived through a Ramadan with them as neighbors, they seem to be secular Muslims. They are certainly a lovely family, but I'm uneasy. Uneasy simply because these people, they don't work. They can't work because they're refugees. They don't speak the language. So you have to understand the rent is about $1,500 US a month. They don't pay that money. Somebody else pays, which translates into my tax euros. Their food is my tax euros. The schools, four children. I mean, three of those children are already in school. And also, because there are so many refugees, migrants, what have you, in Vienna, the housing situation is a disaster. Young families, young Austrian families can no longer find any decent priced housing because it is, quote unquote, taken away from these refugees. You know, it's hard to not get angry because my husband and other husbands have to go to work every day to feed people like my neighbors.
We have to pause for 1 second. More with Elizabeth Sabadish-Wolf, a freedom fighter, mother, English tutor in Vienna, Austria, who I admire greatly and who I always welcome a chance to discuss what's happening in her native land and what's coming our way as well. We'll do more of that right after this.
More with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We are speaking with Elizabeth Sabadish-Wolf, who joins us from her native Austria. She lives in its capital city, Vienna, and she's been painting a picture both of her own history with some of the forces that are at work in Europe these days, not just Austria, but across the continent, and not least the effect that the refugee crisis has had on country after country in that part of the world, including, of course, Austria. And Elizabeth, you were just about to answer a question that I put to you before the break about what the presence of large numbers of relatively young men from parts of the world with a very different culture and tradition and certain practices dictated by Sharia, for example, that are quite at odds with the traditions and values and norms of Austria. And what you've done to try to accommodate what is increasingly problematic situation.
As I was saying, I mean, my life has changed because of the migration crisis and that I no longer use public transportation. I drive always. I use my car, despite the really, you know, good public transportation in Austria, but in Vienna, but I just don't use it anymore because of, you know, my safety concerns. That means I have to drive my daughter around because I'm also not very happy about her using public transportation. It takes up a lot more time. But not only is it that I feel unsafe in public transportation, but also, you know, you see in my neighborhood more and more halal supermarkets coming into existence where you think, why would they need to be right here? And then you look... you walk down the street in my neighborhood and you see more and more and more headscarfed women with strollers and two or three children surrounding those strollers. And then you understand why there's a need for halal supermarkets.
Halal, of course, for those listeners who may not be familiar with the term, a kind of kosher, I guess you might say, religiously dictated dietary practice. And so you have these stores popping up to serve that growing population in your neighborhood. Elizabeth, based on what you've learned over the years, including from your own experience in the nation of Iran that was transformed while you were there from a basically pro-Western, more or less secular Muslim nation under the Shah into a very Sharia adherent and supremacist operation under the Ayatollah Khomeini. Is there something else that is at least implied by the proliferation of these supermarkets and the population for that matter, and I presume mosques as well?
Yes. Mosques are popping up all over the place. I mean, we're getting into the deep Austrian political landscape now, if you're asking about the mosques, because as you know, we have this, Austria has a so-called Islam law, which has been on the books since 1912, which was amended in 2015, and is proving that it's not working at all, despite the government's announcements that mosques would be shut down and imams would have to leave the country. I mean, just yesterday on Austrian news, it was very clear that not a single mosque has been closed. And during the last four months since that press conference given by the government, by the chancellor and the vice chancellor, as a matter of fact, a number of new mosques have popped up and come into operation. So the mosque problem is definitely still there. And those of us who know how mosques operate know that it's never just a mosque, because but it's also a supermarket, a kindergarten, a meeting hall, sometimes even coffee shops associated with these mosques. There's one mosque that I pass quite a few times every week. It's a Bangladeshi mosque, and you see the Bangladeshis congregating, and you have Bangladeshi supermarkets that line the streets. And you have these little enclaves that are going to be bigger. They're going to get bigger and bigger, and as more and more family reunification takes place. So this is a very worrying trend, and we certainly do not have the legal tools yet to address this problem.
But it really does fit into the sort of larger pattern of trying to impel the submission of Austria and other states in the region, non-Muslim states, to, at the very least, various accommodations demanded by the Muslim population, does it not?
Absolutely. I mean, the accommodation is put into place, set in law, by this terrible law on Islam in Austria, because the law explicitly entitles Muslims to halal food, halal slaughtered meat from the army, into kindergarten, into schools, into workplaces, simply because we're in this accommodation mindset. And this has got to stop. And this is what my colleague and I here in Austria are trying to stop, have been trying to stop.
And run into some difficulty with the law as a result. Elizabeth, let me ask you, as you reflect on what's happening in your country, clearly there, and to varying degrees elsewhere in the so-called Visegrad countries, and now it seems most recently Bavaria in Germany, there is a rising tide of opposition to these transformations, specifically to the presence or increasing numbers of migrants who are bringing such cultural change. Talk a little bit about the political lay of the land, if you would, and whether that sentiment is now translating into changes in policy.
Yes, there are policy changes in Austria. The government is doing a fairly good job. I don't want to give them straight A's in my report card, but they're doing what they can. However, you always have to keep in mind that I don't consider Austria sovereign anymore, in the sense that we're in the European Union, and we have to, you know, we have to implement the laws that emanate from Brussels. And, you know, Austria is at odds with Brussels. Many other European Union countries, like the aforementioned Visegrad countries, are at odds with Brussels. I mean, look at Hungary, for instance, and look at Poland, for instance. I mean, these are serious allegations, and they're, you know, it's certainly not an easy situation for the Visegrad countries. But I think I have great hopes that they will remain strong. And at the end of the day, hopefully even be one of the root causes of imploding
of the European Union. And, you know, this goes back to what I said at the very beginning, Elizabeth, in introducing you, that you are very much alive to the reality that we're not simply dealing with Islamism as a threat to Western civilization, or Sharia supremacism, if you will. We're also dealing with this leftist hostility, globalist, some have called it, you know, the centralizing of power, one world government, that really is driven by the left and is increasingly in the service of these Sharia supremacists. So it's a really toxic mix, is it not? And this summer, I know you led for, what is it, the 10th year running, something like that, a delegation of freedom fighters, I think it's fair to call them, from around Europe and also here in the United States. We were very proud to have several of our staff there, as well as others from Canada and so on. Talk a little bit about the fight that went on, not literally, figurative fight, in the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe's annual meeting in Warsaw in September.
Which is an organization that no one seems to know and is an incredibly important organization because its predecessor was the Conference on Security and Cooperation in Europe and was instrumental, was one of the reasons communism exploded, or finally people realized communism wasn't really the savior of the world, and bringing down the Iron Curtain. And it was a very good and very important. I'm a big fan of the CSCE process, the Helsinki process. But after the fall of the Berlin Wall, the OSCE morphed into another one of these supranational organizations that is basically completely useless and just a form of diplomatic speak and doublespeak and friendly words and not so friendly words. It's all talk and no walk.
Isn't it a little more accurate to say at best it's useless, and at worst, it is actually being used as an engine for trying to enforce some of these European speech codes or Sharia blasphemy restrictions. Elizabeth, we have to pause for our last break, but I want to come back to this point that despite the rising sentiment of many in Europe that this is not where they want to go, the supranational government, as you called it, that is in Brussels, and the Turks and others, leftists and Islamists alike, are seemingly trying to impose on you personally, also on many others there. We'll visit about that, and again, what this means for us here in the United States, the lessons we must learn before it's too late. Elizabeth Sabadish-Wolf, for our final installment, straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back to the final segment of this really important, troubling, but informative conversation about what is confronting people who love freedom and are seeking to assure that not only that can they continue to enjoy it, but that their children can as well. An exemplar of that community is our guest. Her name is Elizabeth Sabadish-Wolf. I think of her as a tremendously creative and courageous freedom fighter, operating, it seems, deep behind enemy lines still, even though her government is now at least somewhat more aligned with her thinking, thanks to the evident opposition of many in Austria to what migrants have brought and the left has dictated must be done about them and their culture. Elizabeth, you were talking a little bit about the challenge that you have faced in trying simply to protect freedom of speech in this so-called Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. And What was the experience you had this year? Your numbers were considerably greater than in the past. It seemed as though you had the opportunity to make the case in the absence of the Turks, who had thrown a fit and left the proceedings. But tell us a bit about the story and what it suggests about where things stand.
Well, I have to tell you, Frank, I mean, thanks to your support and that of the donors, of your many donors and supporters, I was able to gather and lead the A team this year. If I had a list of people I wanted with me in Warsaw, I had those people with me in Warsaw this year. And I cannot tell you what an impact. It was incredible, the impact we were able to have on these bureaucrats who certainly did, in the plenary, did not like what we said. But we said it in such a way that they were unable to counter it, because they also did not have the tools anymore. We are such a creative group that we found a way. I mean, you know that our outspokenness in the past years has led to the drafting and forcing of signing the so-called code of conduct, which implied that civil society, of which my delegation is a part of, is forced to adhere to a commitment that was made between states, participating states. And I, as a civil society representative, am not forced to adhere to commitments. I'm not a state. So the group that was behind the code of conduct made a serious blunder. And thanks to the support of the United States government, we were able to sort of kill this code of conduct, so to speak. And that was the fun part, because member after member after member of my delegation went up to the speakers, to the microphone, and had something to say that was not to the liking of these leftist bureaucrats who wanted to silence us. And that totally backfired, and I cannot tell you how proud I am, not only for the support of the Center for Security Policy, but also the United States government, because no one else was willing to stand up and say, you know, this is a forum for freedom of speech. We talk about these commitments. We as a government, United States, have committed ourselves to these commitments, to these principles, and we are now here to uphold these commitments. And you know, the code of conduct runs counter to that. So we may not like what these people have to say, but we should not counter them with the code of conduct, but we should discuss them. This is what I always say. We may not agree, but we should at least be able to talk about it.
This requires the fora to enable that speech to be expressed without restriction. And hats off to you, Elizabeth Savage Wolf, and those that you so ably led there to push back on the efforts that were being made to use that forum as another vehicle for restricting that fundamental liberty. And I'm so appreciative that at least most of the people representing our country there, in government that is, were on your side. But that brings me to the last question that I wanted to ask of you, Elizabeth, in this all too brief interview. When you look at what you're seeing happening around you, when you reflect on what you've learned from hard experience in places like Iran, when you think about the suppression of Western values and traditional freedoms elsewhere in Europe, I know it weighs on you because you do love this country, America. You do love our Constitution and prize the freedoms that it guarantees. I just ask you to sort of take a few minutes to talk about why you are concerned that what is happening in Europe today is headed here and why we must not fall prey to the same sort of tendencies and temptations that have brought Europe to this present very troubling pass.
You know, your constitution is the Chinese wall, and it's crumbling. And that's what I see. Despite President Trump, despite the Republicans trying to hold up this Chinese wall, but I'm very worried about what's happening in the United States. The whole Kavanaugh circus, I watched it. I was almost in tears. I could not believe what I saw. Where's due process? Where's the rule of law? You have a lot of work to do if you are once again going to save Europe like you did in during the Second World War. We need to all understand that the Constitution is the only protection. Again, it's the Chinese wall. It needs to be held up. It needs to be appreciated. It needs to be respected. And that's all I can say as an Austrian. In my view, freedom of speech, the First Amendment, is under constant assault in the United States. At least you still have it. But my worry is that one day you'll wake up and you'll realize there is no more First Amendment. And once you've lost that First Amendment, once you've lost that Bill of Rights, once the Constitution has become obsolete, God forbid, then there's no place to go. After America, there's no place to go. And that's the warning I always tell everybody whenever I speak in the U.S. From a European point of view. We Europeans, not including me, of course, but Europeans have a love-hate relationship with the United States. But at the end of the day, we all look to the United States for guidance, and we will continue to do so despite all the talk, all the rhetoric. And that's actually where I want to end it. I'm worried about the U.S., but I do believe that there's resilience. I think the midterms will turn out good, turn out really well for the Republicans, for the real Republicans. And I hope that President Trump will be strengthened because I believe that he sees the Constitution as his sort of guiding beacon. And I hope that will stay and remain. And I hope there will be a second term for him. And God forbid there's not. We Europeans look to America. We need you. And don't listen to all the horrible rhetoric because, again, you're the ones who are going to have to save Europe. I don't think Europe will be strong enough to save itself. I think we're too far gone already, despite the changes in governments, despite the losses for the socialists in Europe. You know, look at Bavaria just 2 days ago. But I'm not very optimistic. Let's put it that way. I'm not very optimistic for Europe.
Elizabeth, we have to leave it at that. Thank you for your time today, my friend, and for what you do to defend freedom in your small way. Sometimes it may seem, but it's a very big influence on, I think, an awful lot of people elsewhere. Keep it up. Come back to us again, if you would, very soon. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.